two of the exhibitions that are up right now, Drawing Time, Reading Time, which is in this gallery, and Dickens and Walter, Pens and Sketches in our drawing room. And we also have a third exhibition up right now, curated by Nova Benway, William Angleton Fulton, which is downstairs in our lab gallery. And I encourage you all to look around and see all three of the shows after the remarks, if you haven't done so already. So I am very happy to welcome everyone here today for the launch of Emily Dickinson's Gorgeous Nothings, The Gorgeous Nothings. Which is edited by Jen Mervin and Marta Werner, with an introduction by Susan Howe, and published by Christine Bergen and New Directions. We are privileged to have all of these people here with us today, including Barbara Epler from New Directions, and the writers, we'll hear from the writers momentarily. So as you know, this launch is taking place on the occasion of our exhibition, Dickens and Walter Pencil Sketches, and it is a felicitous coincidence that Christine Bergen and New Directions have published not only this new magnificent book about Emily Dickinson, but also a landmark translation of Robert Walser's Microscripts in 2010, which was re-released in paperback in 2012. And in fact, it was through this book that I became familiar with Walser, just as it was through Jen's pioneering scholarship that both myself and I believe Christine as well were introduced to Dickinson's working method. And so also with us today is the masterful translator and Walser scholar, Susan Bernofsky, who will speak briefly about Walser following the demo. So I would like also to add, before turning things over to the speakers, that we at the Drawing Center have published a separate catalog for our exhibition that has an incredible essay by artist Josiah McElhaney. And I encourage people to have a look at that as well. And it is available at our bookstore along with the New Directions book. And Josiah, unfortunately, is not here today, but he really dove in. Oh, he is! I haven't seen him, so wonderful, he is your pick. So he really dove into this text and went beyond the call of duty, and I think everyone will agree that in the process, a new Walser Dickinson scholar was born. So you can ask questions of Josiah as well, because he really knows a tremendous amount about the material now through his process of writing this essay. So I'm going to turn things over to Susan Howe, who is in turn going to introduce Jen and Marta. So Susan probably needs no introduction, but I'm going to provide a brief one anyway. Author of more than a dozen books of poetry and literary criticism, Howe's recent collection of poems, That This, published by New Directions, won the Bollingen Prize in 2011. Her earlier critical study, My Emily Dickinson, was reissued in 2007 with an introduction by Elliot Weinberger, and she's produced three CDs in collaboration with the musician-composer David Grubbs. I hope I'm pronouncing this right. Thief. Souls of the Labyrinth Tract, and Frolic Architecture. And I should actually add that Susan and David will be performing Frolic Architecture at the Drawing Center on December 5th, so I hope many of you will be able to come to that. Howe held the Samuel P. Kaplan Chair in Poetry and Humanities at the State University of New York at Buffalo until her retirement in 2007. The recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, she was elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences in 1999, and served as a chancellor to the Academy of American Poets between 2000 and 2006. Most recently, she was an artist in residence at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. So please welcome Susan Howe.
In 2005, at the Drawing Center's superb show, Three Times Abstraction, New Methods of Drawing, while I was viewing the work of Hilma F. Klint, Emma Klintz, and Agnes Martin, The whole time I was looking at it, I was thinking how perfect it would be to see Emily Dickinson's manuscripts exhibited beside the work of these three pioneers in the field of abstraction. But because she's called a poet and they're called visual artists, that was not, I didn't think would ever happen. And it's happened! So, Marta Werner, a textual scholar, and Jan Berben, an artist and a poet, combined their talents and concentrating, in the case of Emily Dickinson, I'm speaking about the gorgeous nothings in Emily Dickinson because all the waltzer and Susan Bernofsky's beautiful translation and those incredibly just stunning. How did you read them? I don't know. But anyway, this is a New Directions also published them, but I'm here because of the incredible event of the Gorgeous Nothings. Brilliant title, I may say. Anyway, Marta Werner, a textual scholar, and Jan Berben combined their talents at first, concentrating on just the envelope poems. They edited a fine press edition that Steve Clay published for Granary Books. Thank you, Steve, if you're here, I don't know. But anyway, this book is an artwork in itself, but there are only 60 copies priced at about $3,000 each. So not very many people were going to see that. So anyway, it would be out of the reach of most readers. So New Directions, current president, publisher, and my editor, Barbara Epler, in conjunction with Christine Bergen, have co-published these beautifully designed editions at affordable prices in this incredible book. And today, you can actually get these two editions for $30 and $20 if you're fast enough. They're out there. And I was going to say this, so I'm saying it. I want to say, in the case of Dickinson's manuscripts, with their long and extremely complicated editorial history, how did this miracle happen? To me, it truly is a miracle, because as Marta Werner and I well know, it hasn't been easy to counter the iconic edifice of established Dickinson scholarship. The virginal white dress, the large, expensive herbarium, the teeny, teeny writing desk at Harvard, everything so neat and so ordered, and big, powerful Harvard has not been pleasant over the years. But a wonderful man showed up at Amherst running the Dickinson Archive, Mike Kelly, and he, with Claire Hillman, he apparently, according to Claire, it was easy. I mean, he said this idea, which is so wonderful that Claire actually has done this, to get the manuscripts and show them in this beautiful artist space, he allowed it. I can't believe it. It's like Resurrection, this is one of her lines, Resurrection had to wait till they had moved to stone. Well, and the Resurrection is her. So, anyway, Jan came along, and the combination of Marta and Jan together really just has produced to me what's a miracle. But the true miracle is the objects in the other room. And I just, I want to say that I am a little upset that it's wonderful that it's getting so much coverage, but they're still covering it in a way that we're talking about the little scraps and little pieces of ephemera. And there's great writing on those scraps. And the way the writing mixes with the shape, we can never know, did she mean it to or not. But the fact is, this is absolutely great work. It's not just little saved bits of envelopes. And it really, I don't know when that iconic late virgin in the white dress, when that image is going to come crumbling down. But I look upon this as the beginning and the resurrection. And thank you.
Correspondence attests to the considerable care she gave to the ritual act of opening a letter. He
These envelopes have been opened well beyond the point needed to merely extract the letter. They've been torn, cut, and opened out completely flat, rendered into new shapes. To understand how forcefully Dickinson is manipulating the form of the page itself, take an envelope and see how many of these forms you can recreate. You'll quickly find that what looks simple simply is not. There's not one instance of an envelope reopened out into its die-cut shape. Where do those cuts fall, and what shape do they prefigure when the space is opened out? How are some edges cut so surgically clean? At Amherst College Library, Margaret Dakin has acquired what is believed to be Emily Dickinson's lap disc. Its painted wooden surface is positively riddled with myriad fine cuts. Though the written compositions may show considerable speed of thought and hand, Dickinson was not blindly grabbing scraps in a rush of inspiration, as is most often supposed, but rather reaching for writing surfaces that were most likely collected and cut in advance, prepared for the velocity of mind. When Dickinson approached her compositional space to write, she was reading and responding to her materials, angling the page to write in concert with the light rule and the laid lines in the paper, using internal surface divisions such as overlapping planes of paper to compose in a number of directional fields. Sometimes Dickinson's writing fills the space of the envelope like water in a vessel, or funnels into the triangular shape of the flap. She draws additional line segments or arcs to further divide the compositional space. One would think that such a space would feel carved up, cramped, but it doesn't. The page feels bigger yet, as if there has been an insertion of space. In Black Writers, the Visible Language of Modernism, Jerome McGann writes, Dickinson's scripts cannot be read as if they were printer's copy manuscripts, or as if they were composed with an eye toward some straight state beyond their handcrafted textual condition. He continues, Emily Dickinson's poetry was not written for a print medium, even though it was written in an age of print. When we come to edit her work for bookish presentation, therefore, we must accommodate our typographical conventions to her work, not the other way around. Throughout the late 19th century and 20th centuries, editors have painstakingly brought the work to the public, for the most part, the other way around. With the exception of Warner, editors have restructured Dickinson's poems for print in opposition to her manuscripts, overriding her line breaks, deconstructing her formal placement, and omitting variant words and crosses. These manuscripts should be understood as visual productions, writes Susan Howe in the birthmark. In The Gorgeous Nothings, Marta Warner used her command of Dickinson's late works to select manuscripts composed on envelopes to foreground Dickinson's experiments with visual form and variants on the page. Working closely with these manuscripts has taught me the most about Dickinson's construction of what I like to think of as page architecture. The narrow, newspaper-like columns she invents to break poems shorter and shorter, and there's a beautiful example of this in there with that long, so striking manuscript, offer just the solution we might employ to publish her poems correctly with the line breaks you find in the manuscripts. The envelope poems are not a series or discrete body of works. Each envelope has its own complex constellation of affiliations with the manuscript drafts that one can trace through sources in the directory of the book. These writings span 22 years and are culled from roughly 2,300 contemporaneous poem and letter drafts. This batch of envelopes at the Boston Public Library bore Dickinson's letters and poems to Thomas Wentworth Higginson, who apparently opened them with zeal. What she's done for the stamps is pretty amusing. We often gauge a writer's intentions by her published work or by work she submitted for publication during her lifetime, but Dickinson offers us no such certainties. Dickinson rejected print publication of her poems. In a letter to Higginson, she explains, I smile when you suggest that I delay to publish, that being foreign to my thought as firmament to fin. If fame belonged to me, I could not escape her. If she did not, the longest day would pass me on the chase, and the approbation of my dog would forsake me then. My barefoot rank is better. Neither was she secretive about the fact that she was writing poems. She sent more than 300 100 poems to recipients in letters, letters that were often indistinguishable from poetry. We rarely regard this as a form of publication, but in Dickinson's case, it provides some insights into how she contextualizes and presents her own poems to others. She sent the poem, A Root of Evanescence, out to correspondents 6 times over the course of 4 years, each time with subtly altered line breaks. The poem accompanied by a letter or a note like, please accept the hummingbird. It begins, A Root of Evanescence with a delusive wheel. In her private draft, she includes 3 variants for delusive, dissolving, dissembling, renewing. But in all 6 letters, she sends it out with a revolving wheel. I love the private variant draft best, and the subtle changes she brought about in the poem as she addressed each specific recipient. It gives me pause to think of what was sent, what was unsent, what is possible with a specific listener, and what is only possible when you are alone, listening to your poems and their strange, infinite trajectories. Thank you.
On the right wing, the lines afternoon and the west and the gorgeous nothings which compose the sunset keep slant upward into the west. On the left wing, the lines clogged only with music like the wheels of birds slant diagonally upward into the east. And on the smaller, pinned wing, writing rushes beyond the tear or terminus where the scene meets unseen in their high appointment. The singing of birds marks, some even believe, causes both the break and the close of day. If we read from left to right across the contours of the open wings, AA21 appears to record the moment when day falls into night. Yet the grammar of wings is the grammar of discontinuity. The slight variations in the handwriting on opposing wings suggest that the text they carry were composed on different occasions. Moreover, on each wing, writing rushes in opposite directions. To access the text and to answer the question of where we have arrived, we must enter into a volitional relationship with the fragment, turning it point by point, like a compass or a pinwheel, like the wheels of thought, 360 degrees. To say the least, the common meter of the hymn found in Dickinson's early bound poems has not survived this latest flight. In AA21, a sudden acceleration is followed by the snapping or short-circuiting of lyrical cables. In place of melody and measure comes suddenness and syncope. If we look closely at the body of AA21, four additional sets of pinpricks, two along the outer edges of the left wing and two along the outer edges of the right, are visible. Signs that the fragment was imped to other texts. Signs that writing is subject to changes in course, to multiple defections. The poet Lorini wrote in her notebook, W.H. Hudson says that birds feel something akin to pain and fear just before migration, and nothing alleviates this feeling except flight, the rapid motion of wings. AA21, composed on the reverse of an empty, unaddressed envelope, no longer the container for a message, but the message itself, is a harbinger of Dickinson's escape beyond the 40 fascicles, the accumulated libraries of her poetic production, into a freer air, where, to quote Ralph Waldo Emerson, contrary and remote things may seem to cohere. At this juncture, Dickinson no longer thinks of keeping what she acquires through the labor of writing, and her attitude of astonishing recklessness is reflected in the makeshift and fragile textual homes of her late writings, among them the more than 50 envelope writings. The nature of Dickinson's connection to these writings, strange migrants she left behind her, remains mysterious. Slide. For while it is unlikely that she deliberately set out to compose a series of poems, messages, and fragments on envelopes, once we have seen these documents, it becomes difficult to dissociate the text from their carriers. Flocked together for a few moments, perhaps before dispersing again into other equally provisional classifications, they remind us that archives are not always founded on principles of order, comprehensiveness, and objectivity, but sometimes through the more heterodox practices dedicated to salvaging ephemeral remains, remains that a normative vision of literary history might blithely discard. Slide. To the questions, why expend such care in preparing this gathering of 50 so and so many envelope poems written in the latter days of the 19th century? Why go searching in the depths of libraries to bring these works to light in the world? And why, at this moment, there are many possible answers. The beauty of the late documents, the exquisite qualities of so many of the poems and other writings composed on them, are surely reasons enough. But there may still be a more urgent motive for the inhabitants of our own postmodern era to attend to Dickinson's envelope writings. Our obsessive seeking through the new technologies available to us to collapse the distance between the private and the public, inner thought and outer word, self and other, began at the close of the 19th century, when we first defined ourselves in terms of our ability to communicate with each other. While we exist seemingly at the end of this age, Dickinson lived at its beginnings. Slide. In her century, the advent of telephenomena such as the telegraph and later the telephone, like the advent of the internet in our own, seemed both to breach the barriers of time and space and to deliver us into new solitudes. one of the uncanniest documents in the constellation of Dickinson's writings on envelopes is this Western Union telegraph blank. While the urgent message it conveyed has long since been lost, the poems that take its place, glass was the street in tinsel peril, and it came his turn to beg, appear to translate the electrical pulses of the unrecoverable bulletin into new messages associating speed and shock. A message enclosed in an envelope, a poem inscribed upon it and prepared for sending over miles or millennia, is not a bit or byte of information, but an archive of longings. And to send a signal at a distance, it must be kept from dying along the way. Dickinson knew and experienced this before we did. She knew, furthermore, that the interval separating the writer of a message from the addressee, whether seconds, hours, days, or years, is indeterminate and may become infinite. And still she wrote. Her late, unbound writings, scattered by the winds of the future, intercepted by unknown and invisible readers permanently estranged from the writer, remind us of the contingency, transience, vulnerability, and hope effected in all her messages and in all our buried replies. Slide. When Jen Burton and I first met to talk about collaborating on a Dickinson project, we knew each other's work, but not each other. We came from different worlds, she from the world of the studio, and I from the world of the study, and we met on the far margins of Dickinson's poetry. Collaboration is never easy. We knew this, but we were both drawn to the problem of how best to represent the conditions of Dickinson's late works, those works composed specifically beyond the book in its aftermath, and we were both committed to finding a form for her unbound writings that might gather and scatter them at once. But how could we have imagined this moment when the launch of a book of Dickinson's envelope writings would take place in a gallery devoted to drawings, the most transient and ephemeral of works of art, and that is to say, the loveliest? I look around, amazed and deeply moved, feeling for the first time in the 20 years I've worked on Dickinson that I am at last seeing her new directions indeed. I hardly know how to thank the many people who are in effect our collaborators on The Gorgeous Nothings. Steve Clay from Grammar Books, Barbara Eckler from New Directions, Christine Bergen from the Christine Bergen Gallery, Laura Lindgren, also of the Christine Bergen Gallery, Claire Gilman of the Drawing Center, and Mike Kelly, curator of Amherst College Library. Thank you. Thank you beyond words measure for your generosity of spirit and for your visionary gifts. Susan Al and Jen Burvin, what can I say to you? What dare I say? Jen, my beautiful friend, long ago you sent me a book called Nets, and so soon you snared me. To follow Dickinson, to cross into her late work with you, where I have wandered so long alone, has been the most astonishing of passages. I hope you will hold my hand again in further latitudes. Susan, my austere and beloved teacher, you are the muse of The Gorgeous Nothings. It is you who more than 20 years ago foresaw it and called for it. Letters are scrawls, turnabouts, astonishments, strokes, cuts, masks. The physical act of copying is a mysterious, sensuous expression. These manuscripts should be understood as visual productions. Standing here, are we not wrapped in the mirror of the word? All thanks to you, Susan Howe, and all love.
Seven works of fiction by Robert Walser, as well as novels and poetry
Jenny Erpenbeck, Yoko Tawada, Gregor von Retzlori, Liana Wolf, and others. She chairs the Penn Translation Committee and is co-editor with Esther Allen of the 2013 Columbia University Press Anthology In Translation, Translators on Their Work and What It Means. She received the 2006 Helen Edward Wolf Translation Prize and the 2012 Paul Herman Hesse Translation Prize, as well as awards and fellowships from the American Council of Learned Societies, the Penn Translation Fund, the NEA, the NEH, the Leibniz Center for Biography, and the Lenin Foundation. Her translation of Jeremiah Gotthelf's classic tale of horror, The Black Spider, was published in 2013 by New York Review of Books Classics, and her new translation of Kafka's Metamorphosis is forthcoming from Norton in January 2014. So please welcome Susan.
That Christine Bergen published with Barbara Eplow New Directions in 2010, well in advance of the exhibition, which is also out there. Robert Walzer, wonderful, wonderful early 20th century high modernist writer. I can't tell you all about him because I want to be brief. But he's also an author of gorgeous nothings, a writer who celebrated short forms and really writing very beautifully and with great humor about small and ostensibly insignificant items. So the manuscripts you see in the next room, slides, look like this, except they're much clearer because you see them in person. In the last years of his career, really possibly the entire last half of his career, he wrote rough drafts in this microscript form, and that's what you see on display here. The text that you see right here is on a manuscript which is 6 by 8 centimeters. So 6 by 8 centimeters. It's in the book, the full story that's contained under. It's a 600-word story called Swine, a meditation on bestiality and romance. next slide, please. Here you see a manuscript containing the story of the prodigal son, also written in very tiny handwriting. These are 1 to 2 millimeters in height. They were transcribed, so there are 526 such pages that were discovered after his death, and two gentlemen spent 12 years transcribing 6 volumes, Werner Lorion and Bernhard Hesche. I, as a translator, work with their transcriptions rather than with the manuscripts, so I often had occasion to go back to them and say, hey, this word here, are you sure? And then they would go back and look. But they think that Robert Walzer himself may not have been able to read his manuscripts if he let too much time pass. They were drafts that he would then copy over in fair copy and then send out to publishers. And when he copied the text over, he would make vertical slashes to show where he got to the end of a manuscript page. So you can see this on display in the other room too, and you can see the translation of the story in the book microscripts. Slide, please. So this is how he got to this kind of writing. Here's your brief introduction to old German handwriting. It's called Kurrentschrift. Sometimes you hear it miscalled Zutterlin-Schrift because there was a writing reformer named Zutterlin around in the early 1920s who sort of made a more regularized form of this handwriting. But older German handwriting looked like this line. And I've written out modern German, what these letters look like. So if you see the word Nein, the first word, which means no, you'll see that the N and the E are almost identical. The I has a dot on top, which helps. The Nur, the next word, N-U-R, the N and the R also look rather similar. The I, the E-I-N, again, these words, the letters look fairly similar. But note that this handwriting, it has a big emphasis on up and down. It's narrower than the handwriting we have. And so you can get this this cross-hatching effect that you see in the manuscripts. It lends itself to be written very small, but when you shrink it, it also becomes very difficult to tell one letter from another. And so the transcribers said about it that you could, even they, after years of study, could not read these manuscripts. What they could do was guess at what a word was and then confirm the guess by saying, okay, you know, well, this is the letter E, and that one squiggled there is the letter N. You'll see also, look what an SCH looks like. The S and the H look very similar. You can tell it's SCH because there are a lot of SCHs, and so a transcriber is looking for that pattern. Anyone read the names that are below? Okay, now, next slide, please. This is Robert Bowles' real grown-up handwriting from a letter from 1907, which he wrote when he was briefly the secretary to an important art gallery in Berlin. It's the Gallery de Bergen-Secession. Paul Kassirer, who was the brother of his publisher, Bruno Kassirer, hired him to be a secretary, in part on the basis of his very beautiful copper-plated handwriting. And this is a letter to Walter Rathenau, who later became the foreign minister of Germany, but at the time was just, you know, a young man getting around Berlin, reminding him that he promised to buy a painting and that he should pay up immediately because they had already used up, open parenthesis, drunk. He left in that job in 3 months. Next slide. A year after Bowles' death, when these manuscripts were discovered, his legal guardian, who had been unable to read them and who thought that they were an undecipherable secret code, published an excerpt from them in a literary magazine called Du, and says, here's an example of the, you know, indecipherable secret code that Robert Bowles wrote in his last years. But he blew up a facsimile of it. And if you look at the facsimile, you can see that the word Felix appears twice. So it's a dramatic sketch. And on the basis of this, a very young man in Germany who was writing the first doctoral dissertation ever on Robert Bowles, Johann Graven, saw that and said, hey, wait a minute, I can read that. And he wrote Carl Zeilig a letter, which Carl Zeilig either burned or put deep in a drawer because embarrassment, I'm assuming. Zeilig died, and it took another 20 years before people, until the legal guardian died, for people to return to these manuscripts and say, oh, let's start deciphering them. Joachim Graven then did the first decipherings and became Walser's important editor in German, editing all the complete works. A great expert who died 2 years ago, and I'm very sad not to have him to ask questions anymore. Next. Oh, so that. But you saw what the rough-looking blow-ups look like. So this is the tool that the decipherers use to read it. It's called the Gemmefarbensäler, in Linden we call it, sorry, in English, a linen tester. It gives you a magnification of approximately 10 times. And they said that if you blow it up much more, it's not even helpful because of the loss of detail. Next slide, please. But now we have somewhat better magnification thanks to digital technologies. This is, I think, also an exhibition. Here's a card. The text says, basically, sent with the compliments of the author from Paul Solle Publishing House in Vienna. Next slide, please. I'm going to show you the digital blow-up of a part of it. And you can see a little detail, which it, in fact, does help to blow it up more than 10 times. So you can see that when it says, sent with the compliments of the author, the word author is crossed out and written there is instead the compliments of Des Armen Mädchens, with the compliments of Cor Maxi, referring to Max Brod, the friend of Kafka, who was Kafka's literary executor, whom Robert Walser considered a highly mediocre novelist. Max Brod had sent him with this card a copy of his novel. Walser responded with a letter saying, thank you so much for sending me your novel. I was charmed and delighted to hear that you had been on the work at it for over 7 years, a circumstance which was in no way evident while reading it. next slide, please. Here again, to remind you of the scale, centimeters. And along the bottom is a poem. Balzer often did a lot of collaging. You'll see in these manuscripts a poem, a prose text, all cohabiting the same page, sometimes with overlaps of content. That one contains the story New Year's page, which is the last story in the manuscripts. Next, please. Just to give you an example of the kinds of paper he used, here is a tear-off desk calendar. He cut all the pages in half. Also, if Emily Dickinson was opening her envelopes in advance to have them ready, I think he did this too. He would take pages in the desk calendar, cut them to size. He used pieces of old correspondence. He used, receipts. He used honoraria, notices, postcards, business cards, all kinds of material that came his way, and also bits of paper that he got, like the kind of art print paper that magazines might use to do a run. You know, somehow he got a stack of that. So, but he would cut to size, and it looks a little bit like a newspaper column. Next slide, please. And here you see an acceptance letter from the Neue Zürcher Zeitung, a newspaper. And look at the columns. You know, if you look at it sideways, he was very conscious of what his writing looked like on the page, and I think he was basically writing his own little newspaper here. And it's full of wonderful, wonderful news stories, and I hope you enjoy reading them if you read them. Thanks so much for letting me talk.
Yeah.
So we have no idea.
And with the Balzers, I can tell you, at first they were found in a shoebox, literally. And his guardian Karl Zelig had it was Jochen Greven who did it, but Zelig was still alive or something. You'll see numbers written in red on the manuscripts, and those were added, I think, by Jochen Greven when he came to first sort through the manuscripts. Nobody thought they were valuable or anything, so they were confusing, so somebody thought, let's number them. And so he later, cringed every time he saw the numbers, on them. And the numbers have been digitally removed in the facsimile book because they're not part of the original manuscript, but they were part of the archival process. So they weren't archived at all, and now they are in the Swiss National Archive. They are well archived.
Which is the same with Dickinson. I mean, they also have numbers that were added by Leda.
Yeah,
she's one of the people that have. The first person to catalog them, I guess.
Jay Leda is sort of, to me, one of the unsung Dickinson scholars. He published The Years and Hours of William Dickinson. He also did a similar two-volume book on Melville. And it's, I think, one of the best biographies, in a way. It's all, it's collaged documentary work. It's all from taken from letters at the time, newspaper clippings, correspondence between townspeople. So you get this larger sense of her local and national life on the daily level. But Leda was a film scholar. He's one who brought Eisenstein's films to the US and briefly worked as film curator at MoMA. So there's this kind of wonderful, another interdisciplinary moment. But he was the one who described the numbers of the book.
Anyone else? Yeah, thank you to John Mark for this really wonderful, interesting project and book. So I have my own sort of, this is my fragmentary question, detailed, but just a question. I'm interested in stamps. The presence of the stamps on the material of the text, so these are also visual, objects that have text around them, the masterpiece.
I think that the Higginson grouping that I showed very briefly from Boston Public Library is a really wonderful one to study in that. She starts with she does this thing facing Washington up or down or or in reverse, and it's fun to read those choices in relation to the letters and the correspondence as it goes back and forth. It's very playful and it's typical of her wit, I would say. But it's a little trickier to know on the manuscripts in the book, which are coming from all different directions. So they're not necessarily letters that came directly to her. There might be something that was inscribed in the household, never sent out, something that she addressed and didn't send out. It's unclear how or whether they went out and how they came in certain situations. In other situations, it's pretty loaded. If you have a letter either to or from other explorers, it has a certain weight that other letters might not have in terms of what's inscribed there. So, there's less, I see less play with the stamps, but more interaction with the adversary.
Although there is that marvelous manuscript that is on display of a woman in a circumstance where she's very clearly using the stamp in a provocative way.
I mean, she's actually placing the stamp there. That's not an envelope, it's not a letter. I mean, it wasn't mailed. It's actually a stamp in the middle of the piece of paper with then a clip from a newspaper. Referring to George Sand's novel, but I think that's the only case of that kind of use of stamps.
Yeah. Right. I relate it to the cricket.
Right.
I think that there's something, just to bring it around, to put the space that we're sitting in, which is completely covered with people who are using words in their work, And it just seems to me that we're at a moment now, and when you speak of the sort of being a fussy overuse of the original document, where I don't understand what this moment is, but there is a moment where documents such as Dickinson, the Dickinson or the Walser, or these, or the Carl Andres, well, I mean, right now people are using words in visual work. I mean, I'm seeing it, I mean, it seems mm-hmm. to be something, it seems to be a moment now. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I still think there is a difference between an artwork and a poem. I can't figure out what it is. I can't explain why I visually love those mm-hmm. documents in that room of both these people. But I think it's a fascinating moment mm-hmm. where we don't, are they, you know, it's great work. She is a great poet.
Yeah.
He's a wonderful, great writer. So the words that they use are specific, loaded word as object mm-hmm. on the paper. And then you get visual objects using words on the paper. But there's a difference. But yet, maybe it's because of the internet and because of digital, the fact that you can do what you do, showing the Walser blown up on these. I don't know why this has happened, but I just think it's sort of thrilling to consider the space and the other. I happen to just, I'm blown away by Carl Andre. And where is he in this discussion? There's no, I don't have an answer. I'm just kind of drawing it around to this mystery of sound and sight. And can they be separated or
the perfect paraphrasing of really or summation of the questions I was trying to raise with these two exhibitions. So that's really sort of the point here, in a way, to raise questions rather than to necessarily provide answers. And particularly in the other room, Josiah and I talked a lot about this in terms of, you know, what are these things? And even in putting them here, I wouldn't want to claim that they are drawings. I mean, they're not drawings, which, you know, we discussed a lot the installation and whether they would be framed, and I just always thought they would be in vitrines because I think that just leaves their status a bit undecided, that people can sort of decide for themselves what they are. But certainly they're more than texts, and I think we came up with this phrase together that they are visual works by two writers, and there's really no other kind of way to describe them. Obviously, the work in this room is by visual artists, and they are artworks. I think that Carl Andre is a little bit more ambiguous, too, because he actually was considered himself a poet, as well as an artist, whereas I think everyone else in this room, you know, they're kind of currently artists who are working with text. And then there was also the Carl Andre's in vitrines again, although I think he has shown those works framed on the wall, so that I think would have been a possibility with him. But anyway, I think, that was really the point here, was to sort of just put a lot of this material out, and I think artists who are really deliberately engaging those questions, too, in a very thought-provoking way, they're all thinking very intelligently about that question of how the artwork and the text come together, in addition to simply using text in their art. Does anyone else have any? Okay, I think we probably have time for one more question, and then I think this man over here.
I just wanted to say that everyone should come back for the Bob Rainier talk that's part of this, because mm-hmm. I think that's in some ways an answer to what Susan put out there.
That there will be a talk with Bob Rainier and
Charles Bernstein,
On January 5th, in conjunction with these exhibitions.